It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. On Wednesday, Brandon Johnson became the first Chicago mayor to testify before the Congress in almost two decades. He was invited there to defend the city's sanctuary status in front of the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform. In his opening statement, Mayor Johnson criticized some of the rhetoric around sanctuary cities like Chicago, especially when it comes to crime.
I know there are myths about these laws, but we must not let mischaracterizations and fear-mongering obscure the reality that Chicago's crime rates are trending down. We still have a long way to go, but sensationalizing tragedy in the name of political expediency is not governing. It's grandstanding.
Here to talk about how things played out after that is part of our Friday political review is Tessa Weinberg, city government and politics reporter for WBEZ. Tessa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Chicago's sanctuary city law has gotten a lot of attention in the past few years, but can you remind us, it actually goes back long before President Trump was even considering running for elected office. Talk about the history of the policy and what it really does.
Yeah, so the Chicago sanctuary city policy, it's been on the books for 40 years, and it really ensures that Chicago police will basically not be acting and carrying out federal immigration enforcement. It means someone wouldn't get targeted or stopped just on the basis of their immigration status. But it doesn't mean that Chicago police, you know, are never going to cooperate with federal immigration officials. For example, that was a point that came up repeatedly during the hearing that Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson stressed, we are focused on tackling our own crime and our own issues. But if we are served with a criminal warrant, we cooperate with that criminal warrant and with federal immigration authorities. And, you know, this is something that has been getting a lot of attention in Chicago. Just even the last year when we had thousands of asylum seekers coming to the city, the sanctuary city status often came up in those discussions as well. So it's been a hot topic in Chicago for the last several years.
Yeah, well, and you, the way you said that, that's interesting, coming to the city. A lot of those migrants were bussed to the city by Republican state leaders like Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Talk about how Mayor Johnson has reckoned with that in the past few years.
Right. Yeah, that came up during the hearing as well. You know, Chicago received tens of thousands of migrants, many of them, like you said, bussed by Texas Governor Greg Abbott to the city. And Chicago really didn't have the infrastructure initially to be able to care for everyone coming. There were people initially sleeping on the floors of police station lobbies until the city was able to more quickly open up more shelters. Even then, some of these shelters were substandard conditions, people sleeping on floors, you know, not great conditions, you know, being packed together. And so the city was really struggling, and this led to lots of contentious budget fights in city council as the city had to pull more funding to be able to just open enough shelters and continue to really fund this emergency effort for months on end. And that was something all of the mayors were highlighting during this congressional hearing when they noted, we've been on the receiving end of these manufactured and, you know, Republican attacks and using our cities as pawns to send people. But we are still going to step up and care and support for the people who come to our city. That's where our jobs are. And they pointed the finger back at congressional members saying, it's your job to pass comprehensive immigration reform and to address what's happening at the border. We're just here to respond to what's happening in our cities and do our best there.
So the Congress is under the control of Republicans, of course. What do we understand about their aim in having brought Johnson and other Democratic mayors before this committee?
Yeah, I think they were aiming to make an example of these mayors. You know, it was Johnson and then the mayors of New York City, Denver, and Boston, all democratically run sanctuary cities. And they made clear they wanted to hold these cities accountable. Before the hearing even, there was a video that featured a burning U.S. Constitution and really grim music, trying to equate these cities and their sanctuary city policies with the increase in crime. That was a talking point we heard a lot from Johnson of crime is down, crime is down, crime is down. He said it several times to try and, I think, demonstrate that the investments he's already begun to make within Chicago, but Republican members definitely had their own agenda and were really attacking mayors for what they saw as kind of usurping federal laws. Some of them went as far to suggest that the mayors were committing treason or obstruction of justice or floating that they should be jailed and investigated by the Department of Justice. And so I think there was a lot we saw focus from Republican members of wanting to see these mayors comply with what they felt should be the rule of law.
So you referenced there, we heard it in that clip, that one of Johnson's big talking points was crime is down. How else did he defend Chicago throughout the rest of the hearing?
He really stressed that Chicago is a city that is welcoming to immigrants. He referenced Chicago's founding by John Baptiste Pointe-du-Sable and how, you know, it was a city that was founded by a Black Haitian man who married a Native American woman. And that's Chicago's origin story, and that he will continue to uphold that legacy and defend that legacy. We heard him, like you mentioned, talk a lot about crime and investments he's done within public safety to tackle that. And in general, though, he really stuck to that script. I think he stuck to his talking points. We did not see him veer or get as much into a back and forth like some of the other mayors, like I think Denver mayor and the Boston mayor, who were, I think, were willing to maybe get into more of a back and forth. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson stuck to his talking points, which, you know, I think in his defense, probably gave the Congress members less to work with in terms of finding ways to attack him. But I think it also sometimes led to some frustrations. For example, once one Republican Congress member was pressing Mayor Johnson, how much has the city spent on its care for migrants? And Johnson would repeatedly say, we spent about 1% of the past 4 city budgets, but wouldn't give a specific dollar amount, which I think was strategic, but it led to the Republican Congress member accusing Johnson of, you know, not knowing his facts, not running the city well if he didn't have hard numbers in front of him. So there was, you know, maybe some pitfalls sometimes to that approach as well.
Yeah. He did get into a verbal sparring match with Republican Congressman Darren LaHood, who is from Dunlap in downstate Illinois. How did that play out?
Right. They were really going back and forth with the representative, reading some different stats about crime, comparing homicides and murders in Chicago to other cities. And Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson just kept interjecting, saying crime is down. Homicides were trending down in 2024. And I think trying to meet him with his own facts on what crime looks like in the city. But we saw those attacks get personal. The representative brought up a recent poll that was done that showed that Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson had a low approval rating. That came up several times during the hearing. And so I think Congress members kind of, you know, also were going on the personal end as well when it came to some of these attacks. And even though maybe his approval rating doesn't have to do with the sanctuary city policy, the Congress member said that approval rating is evidence that residents aren't supporting what you're doing. I should note that, you know, in Chicago at the city council, there has not been the political will to roll back or undo Chicago's sanctuary city status. Just recently in January, Chicago City Council beat back an attempt to add exceptions that would have allowed for more cooperation with federal immigration authorities. So at a local level, there is a lot of support for Chicago sanctuary city laws.
Tessa Weinberg covers city government and politics for Chicago Public Radio Station WBEZ. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we move now to the rest of this week's major news out of Washington. With me to talk about that is Illinois Public Media's correspondent there, Linda Kenyon. Linda, thank you for making the time, as always.
Always happy to do so, Brian.
So we can spend all of our time probably on President Trump's extended address to a joint session of Congress earlier this week, but there is just a lot of news to get to. So one thing that did come up in that speech was Elon Musk's department, so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. Trump calling Musk the head of the agency actually set off some legal filings in cases trying to limit DOGE's actions. What have you seen happening this week in terms of this ongoing push to lay off and downsize and really purge a lot of people from the federal government?
You know, it has been, to put it simply, a head-spinning experience here, especially in the nation's capital, where we have such a large concentration of federal workers, although not the largest number of federal workers across the country. And because federal workers are all over the nation and the world, quite frankly, especially those working in foreign aid programs. The president did kind of confuse a lot of people with saying Ilan Doge was in charge of the Department of Government Efficiency, which is not actually a department. It's more like a task force. And then with all of the legal filings, he then said he's not in charge of it. And during a cabinet meeting at the White House, he said that Elon Musk is not responsible for cutting federal programs or federal workers. He said that's up to the cabinet members. And he said that the cabinet members will make the recommendations. Hopefully, they will keep the federal workers who are the best and the ones that are very valuable to various government agencies that they work for. And if they don't cut enough, then he said Elon Musk would do the cutting. So that's another sort of about face about who's in charge and who isn't.
What's that expression about the barn door and the horse? I mean, I'm reading this Politico story. Trump stressed that he wants to keep good people in government and not eject capable federal workers en masse. Right. But it seems like that's exactly what's been happening for more than a month now.
Yes. And, you know, the problem is that mistakes have been made. There have been some people who work in, for example, the nuclear industry, people who work at the FAA, people who keep our nation safe, who have been let go and only later to say, oops, we need to call some of these people back. And if you can imagine what that must do to disrupt people's lives, to tell them you're fired, you're not fired. We've made a mistake, please come back. Anybody who's had that happen to them, very, very unpleasant and very unsettling, not just to the worker, but to the family, to entire communities that depend on the money and the commerce that comes from people who live in their communities.
Yeah, and because I have a personal interest in the national parks, I enjoy visiting them. I follow a lot of news about them. I've seen stories of people who are not only losing their jobs, but they find out it's their housing too, because they're living in these remote wilderness areas where the Park Service provides them with a place to live. And they find out, well, you're not only out of work, but you need to leave and soon too.
Right. And then in some cases, they have not been given much time at all to leave. I will say, for example, at the U.S. Agency for International Development, there have been these mass firings, and the employees have been told you've got 1 hour to get out, and in some cases less than that. And it's almost like you're being treated like you committed a crime. And in some cases, President Trump has pretty much said, you know, these people are stealing. These people, you know, some of them have more than one job, so they're stealing from the federal government because they should only have one job. Or there are some cases where he'll say they're not showing up for work. They're no good at their work. They haven't done a good job, and so they need to be fired. And when you make sweeping comments like that, obviously, it's very hurtful, and it doesn't apply to everybody. But when you make a statement from the President of the United States, it carries a lot of weight. And it does, as I say, it does create a lot of hurt feelings and a lot of pain.
Yeah. And I've seen reports of people who had good performance reviews, actually, and were only let go because they were easy to let go because they were on this probationary period. All right. I do want to talk in the time we have remaining some about the fallout from this happened after we taped our conversation last week. But this, I don't know, do we call it an argument, a berating session among President Trump, Vice President Vance, and Ukrainian President Zelensky in the Oval Office? How is that still reverberating in Washington and beyond?
I was at the White House when that happened, and I was not the pool reporter, so I was not in the Oval Office, but I did have eyes on it. And I will tell you that I have never seen anything like that, and I would hope that I never do again. That the international argument in full public view was so unsettling. And quite frankly, if I can take off my reporter's hat and just say, I was horrified. I've never seen anybody treated like that at the White House. It just isn't done. This is a place of dignity. The Oval Office is a place of history and respect, and I just could not believe that there would be that kind of a situation unfolding in the Oval Office. I will tell you also that Volodymyr Zelensky English not being his first language, although he speaks English quite well, he had a little bit of trouble keeping up with what was the rapid fire, I'm sure he felt, attack against him, and being called disrespectful. And why hadn't he said thank you for the to the American people and to President Trump? I will tell you, I've seen him say thank you many, many times. He's been at the White House for more than one administration and has gone so far as even to thank the media for reporting on what's happening in his country. So it was very disturbing. The fallout continues, and unfortunately, so does the war. And while President Trump says that the Ukrainian president has reached out to him to try and reinvigorate, restart the talks, and that there is some positive movement in that direction, it still has created an international shock. And it's certainly not something that you would expect in any White House.
Just about 30 seconds left in our time together. You mentioned that you were not the pool reporter, and that has been a point of contention lately, whereas the White House is now making these pool assignments that I understand for decades had been done by the White House Correspondents Association. And there are some new people in the pool. I wonder what that's been like from your perspective.
There are a lot of what they call new media in the pool now, and the new media are a lot of conservative bloggers, podcasters, etc. And they do attend the briefings, and they are rotated in on the pool. And the wire service, most notably the Associated Press, has been pushed out of the pool. There's a lawsuit pending regarding that, but that was the doing of the White House. I will tell you that the conservative bloggers are very, very friendly to the president. That's why he wants them there. And they do get to ask questions. Some of the questions are very supportive of the president, and that does in many ways bring to mind the concern about whether journalism is objective. And some will say that journalism is not objective, and that's why he wanted those conservative reporters in there. But I know that for the most part, everybody I know in journalism, and I've been in this field a long time, tries every single day to be objective and to be a good journalist and to do a good job and not to take sides. And that's how we were trained.
Linda Kenyon, thank you for sharing your reporting and experience and training with us here on the 21st Show.
You're welcome.
More to come after a short break. Stay with us.